Welcome to the complete audiobook of Ramu Kaka's Leadership Wisdom, Essential Insights for Managers and Leaders. This audiobook is a compiled collection of 29 insightful blogs on leadership and management, written by Ramanujam Thodar as part of the series Ramu Kaka Kagan. Drawing from decades of practical experience in leadership roles, these articles provide actionable wisdom for managers at all levels. The content is thoughtfully organized into 6 parts, each focusing on a critical aspect of leadership and management. Part 1, Foundations of Leadership. This section contains 5 chapters that establish the core principles of effective leadership. These chapters are, the courage to deal with poor performers, extreme ownership, protecting the culture of excellence, decisive leadership, and the loneliness of leadership. Part 2, Building Great Teams. This section features 5 chapters on creating high-performing teams. The chapters include, the meritocracy challenge, mapping the political terrain, talent density matters, challenging the team, and the discipline of performance assessment. Part 3, Becoming a Strong Manager. With 6 chapters, this section develops essential management capabilities. Topics covered are the art of self-marketing, managing perceptions, understanding employee attrition, the power of mindset, ownership versus responsibility, and management fundamentals. Part 4, Developing People. This section contains 4 chapters focused on growing your team members. These chapters explore the power of timely feedback, the manager as teacher, the art of delegation, and why some employees never grow. Part 5, Execution Excellence. This section includes 3 chapters on delivering results effectively. The topics are discipline of execution, effective presentation skills, and the danger of almost done. Part 6, Leadership Wisdom. The final section presents 6 chapters of advanced leadership insights. These include coalition building in action, managing upward, managing peers and senior colleagues, what managers owe their employees, think on your feet, and leadership without authority. In the book version, each chapter combines practical wisdom with real-world examples, frameworks, and reflection questions to help you apply these insights to your own leadership journey. Let's begin with Part 1, Foundations of Leadership. Chapter 1. The Courage to Deal with Poor Performers. At the end of the year, when performance appraisals are done for making decisions to feed into compensation and review process, I have seen managers getting uncomfortable to communicate about the poor performance of their B10, bottom 10 percentile, employees. In many companies, B10 performers do not get any hike in their compensation. This makes the manager even more uncomfortable to have the performance discussion with their B10 employees. Before we get to the communication aspect, let's dwell on the impact of the poor performers on the overall organization. You defeat the purpose of hiring great people if you fail to deal with poor performers inside the organization. It is like taking a favorite drink and watering it down. The weak links in your team determines the pace and overall success of the team. The question you need to ask yourself is, would you rehire this person if given a chance? If the answer is no, then you need to either train them to equip them with right skills, or transfer them to another function to match their competency, or terminate them. Keeping the wrong person lowers the collective self-esteem of the entire team. It diminishes your credibility as a leader. You will lose respect of the best when you don't deal effectively with worst. Remove poor performers when you are on a roll. Do not wait until the bottom falls out. The best time to fix the roof is when the sun is shining. I believe no employee is bad. It is just that they may not meet the expectation of the current job. My favorite example, to drive home this point, is that of engineers finding jobs in different companies. It is not that all companies hire only engineers from IITs. Every engineer finds a job depending on their meeting the expectation of the company that hires them. So, as a manager, you need not feel bad that you are firing a poor performer. It is just that he does not meet your organization's expectations. As a matter of fact, you will be doing great injustice to their career by retaining them in your group. you will give far below average hike, as he, she is B10. Year over year the B10 employee would be getting lower hikes. By letting them go, they will find other companies where their talent meets/exceeds that company's expectation. In my career, I have seen B10 employees who left my organization, growing well in other companies. As a manager, you should care enough to confront the poor performers. Confronting is like tough love. Be polite but firm in giving the feedback as to why they are performing poorly. Have data to back your qualitative feedback. Have 3 to 4 top feedbacks to drive home the point. Most of the companies have the process of PIP, Performance Improvement Process. Put them on this process, by redefining expectations and attach deadlines for attainment. At regular intervals give them the feedback. Do not wait till the end of the PIP tenure to give feedback. If you feel the employee is not improving, then be open to them and ask them to look for opportunities outside of your company. He can use the remaining period of the PIP tenure to actively search for another job. Firing an employee based on poor performance is not easy, but then who said being a manager or leader is easy? Chapter 2. Extreme Ownership. Excerpts from the book of the same name by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin, U.S. Navy SEAL. On any team, in any organization, all responsibility for success and failures rests with the leader. The leader must own everything in his or her world. There is no one else to blame. The leader must acknowledge mistakes and admit failures, take ownership of them, and develop a plan to win. The best leaders take extreme ownership of everything that impacts the mission. This fundamental core concept enables SEAL leaders to lead high-performing teams in extraordinary circumstances and win. Application of extreme ownership is fully relevant in business team in any industry. When subordinates aren't doing what they should, leaders that exercise extreme ownership cannot blame them. The leader bears full responsibility for explaining the strategic mission, developing the tactics, and securing the training and resources to enable the team to properly and successfully execute. If an individual on the team is not performing at the level required for the team to succeed, the leader must train and mentor that underperformer. But if the underperformer continually fails to meet the standards, then the leader must be loyal to the team and the mission above any individual. The leader must make tough call to terminate the underperformer and hire others who can get the job done. Total responsibility for failure is a difficult thing to accept, and taking ownership when things go wrong requires extraordinary humility and courage. But doing just that is an absolute necessity to learning, growing as a leader, and improving a team's performance. Extreme ownership requires leaders to look at an organization's problems through the objective lens of reality, without emotional attachments to agendas and plans. It mandates that a leader set ego aside, accept responsibility for failures, attack weakness, and consistently work to build a better and more effective team. Such a leader, however, does not take credit for his or her team's success but bestows that honor upon his subordinate leaders and team members. When a leader sets such an example and expects this from junior leaders within the team, the mindset develops into the team's culture at every level. As a group, they try to figure out how to fix their problem, instead of trying to figure out who or what to blame. As a leader, in our mind we think we are doing everything right. So when things go wrong, instead of looking at ourselves, we blame others. But no one is infallible. With extreme ownership, one should remove individual ego and personal agenda. It's all about the mission. How can you best get your team to most effectively execute the plan in order to accomplish the mission? That is the question you have to ask yourself. That is what extreme ownership is all about. Chapter 3. Discipline of Execution. The other day one of my colleagues asked me on how to manage slips when working towards an aggressive schedule. Many a time the project deadline is imposed on the team to meet the customer commitments. So how would one go about managing the project in such a situation? In this blog session, I will share my perspective from my experience. The foundations of a good project management lie in the detailed definition of the scope of the project. Defining the scope right becomes even more critical when the deadlines are imposed. Flexibility matrix between scope, schedule, and resources defines the project management. When schedule becomes non-negotiable, the expectation is that scope and resources are flexible. So, one needs to negotiate how much the scope can be reduced, de-scope, and how many additional resources that can be added. Based on this flexibility, the project plan needs to be reworked. One also needs to highlight the risks in meeting the aggressive schedule. These risks need to be clearly communicated and sensitized to the stakeholders. Despite exploiting the flexibility matrix, the risk in meeting schedule is still high, due to reduced timeframe. Some of the common causes of slip in the project are underestimation of task effort, delays in making technical decisions at the micro level, tasks. Delays in handoffs between functional teams, not so rigorous tracking and lack of internalization of the goal by every member of the team. For making a good estimate of the task duration, the detailed scope of the task is a must. Curb the tendency to jump to task execution. Spend quality time thinking about the complete details of the task. Factor into the scope, the specification derivation, architecture analysis, documentation, reviews, closure of action items from the reviews, etc. The effort should be put to make a plan at a day's resolution. Every engineer should know on a given day the tasks that he is going to accomplish. The submodule lead should work closely with the engineers on a daily basis to guide engineers to make right and timely decisions on the execution of the tasks. Many a time the engineer would like to resolve the issues on his own. This may take more time. So the engineers should be encouraged to ask for help when they are stuck on an issue beyond a day. To mitigate the project slips, one needs to track the project rigorously and err in the direction of micromanagement. At the functional level, the project plan should have tasks at a two-day resolution. Tracking them twice a week will help contain the slip and/or at least plan contingency plan early. In the last month of the project, tracking the project twice a week is recommended. I learned from my colleague an interesting end-day rule on communication of slip that he deployed in his team. If a person assesses that his task is slipping by end days, then he needs to communicate about the slip to his team/manager end days before the milestone. This provides opportunity for timely contingency plans. The project manager should keep tab on the handoffs between the functional teams and should work proactively with the functional leads to honor the handoffs religiously. If it means that the functional lead needs to prioritize the interfunctional handoff over his critical tasks, then he should do it. As resources are a critical component in the project management, the manager/lead should work with each team member and sensitize them not only on the importance of meeting the schedule but also the impact to business/team on not meeting it. Every team member should internalize this and be paranoid about the final project goal, not just their task goal. The other critical aspect of project management in meeting aggressive schedule is communication. Communication to both the stakeholders and to the team. Stakeholders don't like surprises. In the event of project delays, the stakeholders would like to know as early as possible. They don't like repeated slips. So the first time you anticipate a slip, assess the slip accurately and forecast a single date that you are confident you will meet, buffer it if needed. The stakeholder may not like the new forecasted date, but you will not be bothered till then. Project leader should exhibit predictability in project execution, as this forms the basis of trust with the stakeholders. For high schedule risk projects, the project lead should identify intermediate milestones that if missed would directly delay the project. The dependency of this milestone to the final project schedule should be communicated to the stakeholders. In the event the intermediate milestone is missed, the risk to the project schedule should be communicated to the stakeholders. This way they get early visibility on the potential slip to the project. Simultaneously, the project lead should communicate to the team on the status and potential risk on missing the deadline. 4. Protecting the culture of excellence. Excerpts from the book Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. There are many instances in business and sports, a strong leader, when he takes charge of a poorly performing team, he turns them around and makes them a better team. Vice versa, a poor leader can take a good team south in their performance. In the book, the author talks about two boat crew teams, one led by a poor leader and the other by an effective leader. The team led by the poor leader was losing. After a few rounds of competition, the leaders of the teams were swapped. It was noticed that in the future races, the earlier team, which was losing, started to win. This established the fact that there are no bad teams, only bad leaders. This case was analyzed and following observations were made. The poor leader whose team was losing was justifying the team's poor performance with many numbers of excuses. In his mind, the leader of the other winning team had been lucky enough to be assigned with better team members. His attitude reflected victimization. As a result, his attitude prevented his team from looking inwardly at themselves and where they could improve. Finally, the leader and the team members focused not on the mission but on themselves, their own exhaustion, misery, and the individual pain and suffering. Though the instructors demanded that they do better, the team became comfortable with substandard performance. Working under poor leadership and an unending cycle of blame, the team constantly failed. No one took ownership, assumed responsibility, or adopted a winning attitude. When the good leader took charge of the team that was losing, he faced the facts, he recognized and accepted that the team's performance was terrible. He didn't blame anyone, nor did he make excuses to justify poor performance. His realistic assessment, acknowledgement of failures, and ownership of the problem were key to developing a plan to improve performance and ultimately win. Most important of all, he believed winning was possible. He focused his team on the mission. Rather than tolerate their bickering and infighting, he pulled the team together and focused their collective effort to the single specific goal of winning the race. He established a new and higher standard of performance and accepted nothing less from the team. Leaders, when they drive their team to higher standard of performance, they must recognize that when it comes to standard, as a leader, it's not what you preach, it's what you tolerate. If substandard performance is accepted and no one is held accountable, that poor performance becomes the new standard. Therefore, the leaders must enforce standards. Leaders must push the standards in a way that encourages and enables the team to utilize extreme ownership. Leaders should never be satisfied. They must strive to improve, and they must build that mindset into the team. They must face the facts through a realistic, brutally honest assessment of themselves and their team's performance. Identifying weaknesses, good leaders seek to strengthen them and come up with a plan to overcome challenges. The recognition that there are no bad teams, only bad leaders facilitate extreme ownership and enables leaders to build high-performance teams. Chapter 5. The Power of Timely Feedback. Supervisors are expected to provide feedback to their employees on their performance. There are two aspects to providing feedback: timeliness and being critical. An organization's performance review process may mandate appraising an employee, say twice a year. But providing feedback to an employee twice a year is not effective. The context settings of the feedback is either lost or forgotten, so the feedback becomes ineffective. Performance improvement is a continuous process and it will be effective only when timely feedback is provided to the employee. The advantage of providing timely feedback is that the context of the feedback is fresh in one's mind. So the feedback will be effective and the supervisor can hold the employee accountable for it. For example, let's say the group's priority is quality of execution, and a bug is found in the design done by an employee. The severity of the bug may be low as the project is yet to be complete, but it provides a golden opportunity for the supervisor to talk to the employee and discuss about it. He can understand the root cause of the issue that led to this bug. If the issue is with the design process, he can act on it immediately. If it is due to oversight on the employee's part, then it reinforces to the employee that he is falling short of the expectation. This will work in his subconscious mind, and he will be more vigilant in the future. If this timely feedback is not provided, then the employee will not feel the pinch of the mistake. Accumulating such feedback and providing them at the end of the year will be too late and ineffective. The second aspect of the feedback is that it should be critical. It should not be sugar-coated. If the supervisor rates the employee based on that feedback, then it is unfair to the employee if he hasn't got the feedback in its true form. Feeling uncomfortable, hesitant, or that one will become unpopular cannot be the reasons for the supervisor not to be critical of his employees. Supervisor who truly cares for his employees will be critical of them. Parents love their children, but that doesn't stop them to be tough with their children when they make mistakes that is unacceptable. The same relationship holds true between a supervisor/employee in the professional context. Also, the supervisor needs to provide feed forward. Set the expectations for the next level, so that the employee knows what he needs to improve to be successful at the next level. Chapter 6. The Art of Self-Marketing. Chapter 6. Dictionary defines marketing as the action or business of promoting and selling products or services, including market research and advertising. It is easier to comprehend marketing when it is related to products or services. On the other hand, self-marketing may connotate boasting, show off, and in extreme cases may be interpreted as narcissism. But in the professional world, doing self-marketing within the realms of ethics is much needed skill in the highly competitive world. Engineers, when they work on solving a complex problem, do not mind publishing their work as a technical paper in their professional magazine. They don't consider it as show-off activity, rather that it is their professional responsibility. But the little opportunities at work that may not merit publishing a technical paper, but good enough for knowledge sharing, doesn't get marketed. The engineer may feel embarrassed to market, or even lazy to showcase his work coming out of such little opportunities. When the push to do so comes from their manager, they hesitate, but they do it. They don't feel embarrassed that they are showing off. But letting such golden opportunities of self-marketing to their managers is risky, as not all managers may be aware of such opportunities. These opportunities help not only marketing an individual's work but also that of the organization. For an individual's professional growth, besides papers and patents, internal recognition through knowledge sharing is also critical. These opportunities of self-marketing are perfect to accumulate such internal recognitions. One also needs to look for opportunities for external recognition. Writing white papers in industry magazines, giving tutorials or lecture in universities, writing blogs, replying to a question on forums like Quora, sharing ideas on LinkedIn are good avenues to self-market oneself. Self-marketing helps individuals improve their image and reputation to advance their careers. It gives individuals more opportunities to effectively communicate their values, skills, experiences, and vision to potential employers. Successful self-marketing helps employees separate themselves from the hundreds of other applicants who may be competing for the same job. Make self-marketing a habit. Dedicate a portion of your career plan to work on self-marketing efforts. Finally, as you start setting goals for this year, do remember to set a couple of goals for self-marketing. 7. Decisive Leadership. Chapter 8. Excerpts from The Unwritten Laws of Business. Making decisions is the most difficult and important part of manager's job. Some managers have a terrific struggle deciding even minor issues, because they never get over being afraid of making mistakes. Few principles that will help in decision making. 1. Decisions will be easier and more frequently correct if you have the essential facts at hand. It will therefore pay to keep well informed and to bring out the relevant facts before attempting a decision. Sometimes you may not have all facts and are still expected to make a decision. When in doubt, ask yourself, am I likely to lose more by giving a snap judgment or by waiting for more information? 2. You do not have to be right every time. It is said that a good executive needs to be right only 51% of the time, although a better percentage will serve you better. 3. The very fact that a decision is difficult usually means that the advantages and drawbacks of the various alternatives are pretty well balanced, so that the net loss cannot amount to much in any event. In such cases, it is frequently more important to arrive at some decisions, any decision, promptly than to arrive at the best decision ultimately. So, take a definite position and see it through. 4. It is futile to try to keep everybody happy in deciding issues involving several incompatible points of view. By all means, give everyone a fair hearing, but after all parties had their say and all facts are on the table, dispose the matter decisively even if someone's toes are stepped on. The following criteria are helpful in choosing a course of action when the factors are indecisive. Ask yourself these questions. Does it expedite and forward the undertaking, or does it only produce procrastination and delay? Is it fair and square and above board? Is it line with established customs, precedents, or policy? A good reason is generally required for a departure. Is it line with a previous specific decision or understanding? What are the odds? Can we accept the risk? How does the possible penalty compare with the possible gain in each of the alternatives offered? Do not allow the danger of making a mistake to inhibit your initiative to the point of nothing ventured, nothing gained. It is much healthier to expect to make mistakes, take a few good risks now and then. Managing Perceptions. Chapter 9. As you grow in your career, you will be judged not only on what you do, but on how you do it, so other people's perceptions and evaluations of you play an important role in your career. People with the skills to influence others' perceptions have a far better chance of controlling their own destiny. How your work is being perceived by the key stakeholders is equally, or more important. Managing perceptions becomes challenging when the key stakeholders are not co-located but are in a remote site. Managing perceptions needs concerted and conscious efforts. Following methods helped me. 1. Regular weekly calls. Set up a weekly call with the key stakeholders, need not just be the boss, but peer managers as well. Use these calls to talk less about the project status, but more about the team's accomplishments and issues. One of my team members spent more than 2 weeks debugging a critical issue. I knew it as I keep discussing with him regularly. But my manager didn't know about the same, till I brought it to her attention, in one of the weekly calls. Similarly, if one foresees any risk or issues with the project, use the weekly call to communicate about them. 2. Instant messaging/WhatsApp. While WhatsApp has become a universal instant messaging platform for personal use, it can be very effectively utilized for instant official communication as well. Communicating over email on an issue is not as fast as doing it over WhatsApp. Chatting over the issue on WhatsApp gives the perception of real-time discussion. 3. Travel. Visiting remote site at regular intervals is important to build good relationships with the peer managers and other stakeholders. Use these visits to get their feedback about the team and take actions to address them. Also use these visits to share the innovations and/or method improvements that the team has made. 4. Improve the TAT, turnaround time, on email response. Managers may be in the CC list of many emails between the team members. The manager needs to assess the importance of some of the emails and ensure that the team is responding to these emails in a timely manner. Untimely responses for many of the emails, some not critical, will create a perception that the team is not supportive. 5. Schedule unplanned reviews, going back to the example that I talked about in number 1. The team has been working on the critical issue for more than 2 weeks. Instead of sending an email update on the progress, we scheduled a detailed review of the debug that the team did. Before the review, the remote team didn't have a good feel that my team was on top of the issue. The review changed the perception completely. I haven't heard any questions on this issue for a week now. So on issues that one sees getting dragged and discussed over email, make it a point to schedule a review with all concerned people and address them. 6. Transparent communication. Establish process for transparent communication. Use web tools to share the details of the projects across cross-functional and remote teams. My team uses Confluence as a web tool to share the various details of the project. Instead of PowerPoints hidden as attachments in an email, they are all put in Confluence and shared. 7. Senior leaders don't like bad surprises. We had an issue with the project and had violated the boundary line agreement. There was a planned meeting with the senior leader to go over this violation. Everyone was dreading about this meeting. The previous day, my manager had a one-on-one call/WhatsApp messaging with the senior leader and brought him up to speed on the issue. The review did not become a beating session, but more of what could have been done to avoid the violation. I learned that day how to manage perception when communicating bad news. 8. Be visible at strategic moments, in project review meetings or town hall meetings, participate actively and ask relevant questions. Keeping mum in a meeting doesn't help improve visibility. It's been said that perception is reality. Unmanaged perceptions become a reality that wasn't intended, so manage them effectively. The Meritocracy Challenge. Chapter 10. Environment dictates behavior and behavior dictates results. An organization that supports culture of entitlement has the following characteristics: job security, raise not based on performance, promotions based on years of experience and not performance, sugar-coated reviews, managers spend equal time on all, popular managers instead of effective managers, yesterday's hero reaping benefits from past accomplishments, setting no-brainer performance standards. On the contrary, the culture of merit has the characteristics, supports meritorious people, weed out the weak ones, reward for performance, accountability, hostile to mediocrity, champion heroes and punish slackers, everyone comes to prove themselves again and again. Culture of an organization may be anywhere in this entitlement to merit spectrum. Leaders' focus is to move the needle of culture towards the merit. Culture of merit brings forth discretionary effort. It is the effort. Extra level of performance people give when they want to do something. 5 steps to move from entitlement culture to merit culture. 1. Set the bar of expectation high, where the chances of meeting them is 50-50. 2. Redefine expectations and deadlines for people with more experience. 3. Have one-on-one to emphasize the importance of meeting the expectations. 4. Maintain pressure to perform, fast feedback on performance, accountability for results and quick reward. 5. Stick to your guns. People may resist. Exert positive pressure and confront the behaviors if they go back to old ways. Leaders must create optimal amount of pressure to perform. One is not at his best when the life is too safe. They become lazy and complacent. Best people will respond positively to pressure, while weak people will find it stressful. Mapping the political terrain. Chapter 11. This is an excerpt from the book, Get Them on Your Side, by S. Bacharach. I will summarize the notes from this book into 2 GAN sessions. The first session in Mapping the Political Terrain. A good idea is not enough, you need political competence. Many people know what needs to be done, but few are able to leverage the energy and support of others in order to do it. The key to true empowerment is the development of the political competence. The person with political competence is situationally aware, he anticipates, and reacts to the interests, agendas, and intentions of others in the organization. In order to get results, you have to identify the allies and resistors, you have to get the buy-in, you have to build coalitions, and you have to lead politically. Political competence is the ability to understand what you can and cannot control, when to take action, anticipate who is going to resist your agenda, and determine whom you need on your side to push your agenda forward. It is about knowing how to map the political terrain, get others on your side, and lead coalitions. Being political, in its most attractive light, is being aware of interests of others, finding areas of common ground, bringing others on board, and leading them in pursuit of goals. Politics is part and parcel of making things happen in organizations. Any idea you have for an organization is based on your own unique interpretation of organization, past, present and future. Other would perceive their way. There is no such thing as a common prism. Everyone is coming from a different place. For every initiative you launch, there will be pockets of resistance and criticism directed towards your idea and towards you personally. Political competence requires that you anticipate what they are going to say. To map the political terrain, you need to analyze the goals and approaches of the stakeholders. A simple 2x2 model between goals and approaches can help in this process. The goals can be classified into 1. Tinkering goals, incremental improvements in the status quo. People in this category are risk-averse. Focus is on short-term. They prefer doing things which have worked in the past, a little better and faster. 2. Overhauling goals. What interests this set of people is not the rules and operations but the underlying motivation. They look for fundamental transformation, so they do dramatic retooling. The approaches can be classified into 1. Planning approach. People in this category believe that everything that affects us can be known and prepared for. They are most concerned with control. Planning approach is based on the optimistic assumption that future can be predicted and controlled. 2. Improvising approach. People in this category don't make concrete plans, but rather react as events unfold. They are prepared for fluid adaptation. They are concerned with autonomy and independence. Analyzing the goals and approaches of others will help you decipher their agenda. The real conflict is not between those who resist change and those who advocate change, but it is over the agenda. 1.1, tinkering, planning, of the matrix can be named traditionalist agenda. The rhetoric of this agenda is that change should be regenerative, purpose is to integrate past successes into current reality. One will argue that once abandoned routines are best way to deal with uncertain environments. People with this nature would not stop the change initiative but slow down the change process. 1.2, tinkering, improvising, of the matrix can be named adjuster agenda. Adjusters react to change only when necessary. The question for the manager pursuing an adjuster agenda is one of timing, when to move. They are reactionary, responding to external factors. One needs to persuade this type of people that it is time to cross the bridge. Highlight that the time is now for the initiative. 2.1, overhauling, planning, of the matrix can be named developer agenda. This person is committed to stay on top of things. They believe scientific or systematic method is essential for predicting and controlling impending change. They love change initiatives. They are proactive in the pursuit of agenda to which they feel ownership. Their conviction can give momentum to the initiative. 2.2, overhauling, improvising, of the matrix can be named revolutionary agenda. Their goal is to impose completely new set of ideas that will fundamentally transform the mission. They thrive on new ideas. These people can undermine your efforts. They will never be content and can lead you over the top. People differ in either goals or approaches. Once you identify your agenda belongs to what category, you can identify the agendas of others relative to yours. This will help in identifying the allies and resistors, so that you can create your coalition to push your agendas. Coalition building in action. Chapter 12. In the earlier blog, mapping of the political terrain and the model to identify the agenda and the approaches of others in the organization was discussed. Continuing with the topic of getting them on your side, in this session we will talk about identifying allies and resistors and the need for creating a coalition. To start with, determine your agenda, as it relates to your initiative, traditional, adjuster, developer, revolutionary. List all key stakeholders as they relate to your initiative. Include those who may have competing objectives, as well as those who are key decision makers. Identify agenda of each stakeholder. Analyze the list, identify those who are like you, those who are in opposite quadrants, and those who share similar goals or implementation strategies. The challenge is not to simply identify high-profile stakeholders who will be impacted immediately, but also to identify invisible stakeholder who will be impacted down the road. Identify the agenda of the stakeholder. Remember previous initiatives and how they reacted. Do roleplay to get into their shoes and anticipate the behavior. Ask others their views on how the person will react to an idea in a manner that doesn't telegraph your intentions. Analyze your allies and resistors. Those who share your agenda will be allies and who oppose it are resistors. Those who share the goal are potential allies, and those who share your approach are potential resistors. With allies, solidify their support, coalesce and get them behind you in a solid and consolidated way. With potential allies, who will be on the fence on your side, convince them of your approach. With potential resistors, whose legs are dangling on other side, you should neutralize their influence, or you should convince them to move to your side of the fence. With potential resistors, try to neutralize them. The next step is to create your coalition. By having others join you, you are less vulnerable. You can harmonize your differences and reduce resistance, pursuing at least the appearance of common course of action. Building coalition is a necessity for survival and success. Coalition is a proactive mode of enhancing participation. It is distinctly different from giving through empowerment. Coalitions are based on your recognition of others as critical to the political reality of getting something done. Coalition is critical when your initiative has far-reaching consequences. When your efforts are perceived high risk and complex. When your initiative vies for scarce resources. Coalition is important at every stage of the change initiative. When you are preparing for the change, coalition helps spread risk and helps create critical mass. When initiating change, it helps in overcoming resistance and secure legitimacy. When implementing change, it helps avoid sabotage and to get over the hump to make the change. Lastly, when stabilizing change, it helps deflect revenge and maintain support for next project. Establishing your credibility is the next step in the process of getting them on your side. We will talk about it in another blog session. Density Matters. Chapter 13. The 10 top traits of successful people are: 1. They work hard. Yes, they play hard, too. They get up early, they rarely complain, they expect performance from others, but they expect extraordinary performance from themselves. 2. They are incredibly curious and eager to learn, they study, ask questions and read, constantly. Repeated success is not about memorizing facts, it's about being able to take information and create, build, or apply it in new and important ways. Successful people want to learn everything about everything. 3. They network, they know lots of people, and they know lots of different kinds of people. They listen to friends, neighbors, co-workers, and bartenders. Successful people have a Rolodex full of people who value their friendship and return their calls. 4. They work on themselves and never quit. While the overnight wonders become arrogant and quickly disappear, really successful people work on their personality, their leadership skills, management skills, and every other detail of life. Successful people don't tolerate flaws, they fix them. 5. They are extraordinarily creative, they go around asking, why not? They see new combinations, new possibilities, new opportunities and challenges where others see problems or limitations. Successful people create stuff. 6. They are self-reliant and take responsibility. Incredibly successful people don't worry about blame, and they don't waste time complaining. They make decisions and move on. Extremely successful people take the initiative and accept the responsibilities of success. 7. They are usually relaxed and keep their perspective, even in times of stress or turmoil. Highly successful people keep their balance, they know the value of timing, humor, and patience. They rarely panic or make decisions on impulse. Unusually successful people breathe easily, ask the right questions, and make sound decisions, even in a crisis. 8. Extremely successful people live in the present moment, they know that, now, is the only time they can control. They have a gift for looking people in the eye, listening to what is being said, enjoying a meal or fine wine, music, or playing with a child. They never seem rushed, and they get a lot done. They take full advantage of each day. 9. They look over the horizon to see the future, they observe trends, notice changes, see shifts, and hear the nuances that others miss. Extremely successful people live in the present, with one eye on the future. 10. Repeatedly successful people respond instantly. When an investment isn't working out, they sell. When they see an opportunity, they make the call. If an important relationship is cooling down, they take time to renew it. When technology or a new competitor or a change in the economic situation requires an adjustment, they are the first and quickest to respond. Understanding employee attrition. Chapter 14. What happens in the psyche of the employee when he is thinking of quitting? It is common sense that the employee has been brooding about quitting for quite some time. We can divide the process of quitting into three stages. The first stage is when the employee is unhappy with his career in the current organization. Second stage is when he ventures out and starts to interview with other companies. Third stage is when he has accepted the offer and then puts his paper in the current organization. In the first stage, the employee could be unhappy with his career either due to his salary or due to not so good manager/org culture, or it could be due to him pursuing his career goals. In this stage, if the company is doing good and in general if the group is doing fine, then the employee may delay pulling the trigger. He hopes that over time his needs will be met in the current company. There could be multiple triggers for him to go the next stage. In the case of salary, if his lifestyle has changed due to events like marriage, then he expects more money sooner, to address his liabilities. In the case of not so good manager/organization, it could be just one bad incident and he may decide to quit. In the third case, if he feels he has given enough time to the current organization or if there are any organization changes due to which he realizes his goal may not be met, then he may decide to quit. In all these cases, the employee has given sufficient time before he ventures out. The best time to avoid attrition is in this first stage, as the employee has not ventured yet. If the current manager or organization is not able to assess that the employee is in the first stage, then they have lost a golden opportunity to retain the talent. It is difficult for a manager to assess the second stage. Clues like random leaves or working from home can help, but given that working from home is common, it is difficult to find. Sometimes if you see the employee spending time with other not-so-common colleagues, then it can be a clue. But honestly, a manager cannot be Sherlock Holmes, or it may not be morally correct for him to doubt the employee's intention. As assessing that the employee is in the second stage is difficult, so nothing much can be done. The third stage is when the manager/company comes to know about the employee's decision to quit, because the employee informs him. At this stage, 90% of the time it is difficult to retain the person. The decision-making process of the employee is skewed in favor of the new company. He will compare the negatives of the current company, he has real data or his assessment of the real data, with the potential positives of the new company. As a manager, you risk downplaying the potential positives of the other company, and you cannot go too defensive on the negatives of the current company. Both these approaches do not convince the employee. At this stage, trying to provide options in other groups that matches with the opportunities of the other company is futile, as the employee has already made up his mind. The employee will go through the motions to keep HR/manager happy so that he can have a comfortable and peaceful exit. At the third stage, it is very late to take any actions to avoid attrition of the employee. The best bet is in the first stage. Sometimes I feel, isn't it fair on the employee's part to express his intention to seek other opportunities, before he actually does it? But then if you dig deeper, the right question to ask is, what is the organization doing to make the employee feel comfortable to have such difficult and crucial conversation? So, the solution to avoid attrition is not after the employee has puts his paper, but to build an organization where the employees can trust the system and managers to freely express their career issues. This starts with purposeful yearly development plan discussions, creating right career opportunities, competitive compensation, fair appraisal process, and creating a good work culture. The Power of Mindset. Chapter 15. A simple belief about yourself guides a large part of your life. Much of what you think of as your personality actually grows out of this mindset. If you think your qualities were carved in stone, you were smart or you weren't, and failure meant you weren't. If you have a certain amount of intelligence, a certain personality, and a certain moral character, well then you better prove that you have a healthy dose of them. If you think success is about proving you're smart or talented. If you don't succeed, you probably don't have the ability. Then this belief makes you a person of fixed mindset. There's another mindset in which these traits are not simply a hand you're dealt and have to live with. In this mindset, the hand you're dealt is just the starting point for development. This mindset is based on the belief that your basic qualities are things that you can cultivate through your efforts. The belief that cherished qualities can be developed creates a passion for learning. The passion for stretching yourself and sticking to it, even when it's not going well, is the hallmark of the growth mindset. In one world, the world of fixed traits, success is about proving you're smart or talented. In the other, the world of growth mindset, it's about stretching yourself to learn something new. In one world, failure is about having a setback. Getting rejected. In the other world, failure is about not growing. It means you're not fulfilling your potential. In one world, effort is a bad thing. It, like failure, means you're not smart. If you were, then you wouldn't need effort. In the other world, effort is what makes you smart or talented. In one world, everything is about the outcome. In the other world, you give your best regardless of the outcome. In one world, if things get too challenging. When you're not feeling smart or talented, you lose interest. In the other world, you thrive on challenges as it provides good opportunity for learning. In one world, confidence becomes fragile due to setbacks, outcome-focused. In the other world, you may not need the confidence as you are not afraid of setbacks and you are keen in the learning experience. Alfred Binet, the inventor of IQ, designed it to identify children who were not profiting from Paris public schools. IQ test wasn't meant to summarize a person's unchangeable intelligence. Albert Binet says that with practice and training one can manage to increase one's attention, memory and judgment, to literally become more intelligent than before. Intelligence is not a fixed prior ability, but with purposeful engagement one can achieve expertise. So, what you think is your mindset, fixed or growth? You have a choice. Mindsets are just beliefs. They're powerful beliefs, but they're just something in your mind, and you can change your mind. The mindset that you adopt for yourself profoundly affects the way you lead your life. Ownership versus responsibility. Chapter 16. Leaders are expected to have many positive traits. One of the important traits that is a superset is the ownership trait. This trait helps leaders meet many of the challenges that they face. There are many examples to quote on ownership, but in this post, I will take three examples to drive home the point. 1. Let's say you are one of the functional leads of the project. How would you measure your success in the project? Does meeting a function's goal considered success? What if functional team success doesn't translate to the project/group success? If you were to wear the ownership hat, then you wouldn't restrict yourself just to meet your functional goals. You would go beyond your silos and influence other functions, and when needed, help other functions to meet the project goals. You go beyond silos and collaborate across many functions. In the leadership parlance, the words initiative, influencing, collaboration, etc., describe this trait. But all these are encapsulated in a single trait, ownership. 2. Let's say you are a very experienced technical expert. Let's say the project that your team is working on is going through a resource crunch. Would you roll up your sleeves and do some of the mundane, for your level of expertise, work to help the project? In many established corporate companies, people limit themselves to their defined roles/responsibilities. They don't want to take up other roles, or are hesitant, when they are asked to do so. But if you work in a startup, sense of ownership by definition is high, there are no such boundaries between functions. Resources move freely across functions to accomplish the end goal. No one waits or needs to be told that he should wear a different hat temporarily, as that is the need of the hour. Doing what it takes to make the project successful means taking ownership. Let's say you are on an international travel and you reached your destination airport. Let's say your policy entitles you for a taxi service, which is expensive, to your hotel. Let's also say that there is a train connection available to reach your hotel, but this needs you to walk a bit. What would you do? If the discomfort is less, would you take the train, which is cheaper, or would you use your company policy entitlement to take the taxi? Let's say you go through the same experience as a founder of a startup. What would you do then? If you have a sense of ownership, you would take the train. Efficient use of company's resources, as if it were your own company, is an example of ownership mindset. When one has ownership mentality, his only pursuit is to make the project/group/company successful. He will motivate the team when the chips are down and be tough with the team when poor choices are made. He will not whine but find ways to address the concerns. He will hold himself and others accountable. He will challenge his peers. All the time he will keep the big picture of the end goal in mind. All his actions are directed towards this goal. If he spots an issue in any team, he will bring the attention to it in a constructive way to resolve it. He will proactively seek help when needed and reach out to others when they need help. He will make tough calls and stand by it, if he believes that it's the right thing for the project. Essentially, every action of his will be in the interest of the project or company. The Manager as Teacher. Chapter 17. This blog is influenced by the book Governing Business and Relationships by Apartha Sarathy. The law of karma states that every current action produces a future effect. In philosophical terms, the effects could be good or bad karma, which when it fructifies, either gives one happiness or sorrow. In the business or organization context, future success is defined by the proper actions done today that are aligned with the long-term strategy. The ideal action is made up of three essential constituents: concentration, consistency, and cooperation. A practitioner of these three disciplines has the appropriate action to command success in his field of operation. Concentration is the art of focusing the mind in the present. The human mind has a natural tendency to slip into worry of the past or anxiety for the future. Concentration is the technique exercised by your intellect to hold the mind on the present action without allowing it to drift into the past or the future. At the individual level, concentration helps one to develop peace within himself. In the organizational context, concentration is the focus that is needed to achieve long-term goals in the midst of chaos created by the changing environment or priorities. Productivity at work is directly dependent on the employee's focus on the job. Less as he is distracted on his own, web surfing, WhatsApp, etc., or by parallelization of tasks that are needed to meet conflicting project requirements, the more productive he will be at his job. At the business level, lack of focus could come due to conflicting metrics, meeting internal goals to keep upper management happy vis-a-vis the actual customer/business requirement. Lack of focus or concentration results is lower productivity. Consistency. The second discipline is to be consistent in what you do. Having set an ideal to reach for, a goal to achieve, your actions should flow in that direction. You need a strong intellect to overcome mind's distractions and keep the actions going in the set direction. This technique of channeling your actions towards the goal is consistency. The practice of consistency lends power, strength to your action. At employee level, consistency in performance is needed for his success. At the business level, predictability in product execution, consistency in product roadmap and business strategy is crucial for the success of the company. Cooperation, the third discipline is cooperation. To achieve an objective, you need a spirit of cooperative endeavor. Even for an individual goal to be met, there are usually external conditions that need to be conducive. A spirit of cooperation would enable the external conditions to be conducive. In the business context, it is difficult to be successful and productive in a business without the active cooperation of colleagues. Over time, teams that are not cooperating with each other not only bring the company down but themselves. This principle applies to companies, communities, and countries. In the current situation, coming out of this pandemic, every nation needs cooperation from their people and people of other nations. Maintaining the above 3 CS of disciplines of actions, spell success and productivity in any field of endeavor, for an individual and for companies. Managing Upward. Chapter 18. As a middle manager, one needs to walk on a tightrope balancing the aggressive expectations of the higher-ups and leading the employees below to meet such expectations. If you push back on the expectations of the upper management, you would come across as a defensive leader. On top of it, if you lean toward supporting the people that you lead, then you can be construed as not challenging the team, and in some worst case even can get termed as a union leader. So what strategies can you apply to tread this fine balance? In this GAN session, I share from my personal experience 3 strategies. 1. Provide options and not excuses. If a goal is easy, then anyone can meet it. You don't need a leader for it. You need a leader when the goal seems unachievable. I am sure many of you would have faced situations when a deadline is imposed upon the team by external constraints, customer samples date, to meet the metrics of the group, etc. In such a situation, trying to provide facts to show why this goal is tough to meet doesn't solve the challenge. You will be construed as giving excuses. The upper management is expecting you to provide solutions. Leader is expected to provide options. Narrowing the scope of the project for the first release, asking for more resources, people, consulting services, etc., are some options that one can put forth to meet the goal. The key thing here is the mindset of the leader. He needs to internalize within himself and his team that the goal cannot be compromised. He should sell the vision as to why this goal is critical for the group and the company. Along with the team, he needs to brainstorm ways to meet the goal and state up front the risks and also seek the needed help. 2. Constant communication. Senior leaders don't like surprises. More so if the surprise is bad. So, one needs to consciously keep the senior leaders aware of the progress and issues, if any. Talking to a senior leader over phone or even texting messages is a good way to manage the outcome of the bad surprises. Just stating the issue and not knowing how you plan to resolve it is not acceptable. You need to be humble in your communication and also provide a clear mitigation strategy for addressing the issue. You need to give them the confidence that you are on top of the issue. 3. Motivating the team. Going after an aggressive goal is possible only if every member of the team is committed to it. This commitment has to be voluntary and cannot be forced upon the employee. For the commitment to be voluntary, the employee has to be bought into the vision/goal. So, communicating about the vision/goal at regular intervals is critical. You should work closely with the team to feel the pulse. Not every person will be fully motivated. There will be few who may not be able to take the pressure. You need to give such people more leeway and ensure that they don't break down. As you are close to the target, the anxiety of slipping will be high, and it may cause tempers to run high among the team. As a leader, you should be calm and give the confidence to the team that you are behind them. Having come so close to the target, if some slip is inevitable, then you should not admonish the team, but support them. They need to know that you are with them when the chips are down. In my experience, I have seen that despite the best efforts, sometimes the team may fall short of the goal. But the business team that has good customer relationship can manage small slips with the customers and still not lose the business. Any day setting higher expectations and falling short a tad is better than setting low expectations and meeting them comfortably. The Art of Delegation. Chapter 19. While there are many skills that a good leader should acquire, delegation skill is one of the most important skills. This is the skill that helps create bandwidth for the leader to work on critical and strategic activities. Delegation does not come naturally to many aspiring leaders, as they feel they are losing control if they have to let go of some of the activities for others to do. The uncertainties of the strategic activities push the leaders to do current urgent activities which are in their comfort zone. This works against delegating the same to others. There is also a fear in delegating the work. What if the person who takes up the delegated work does not do a good job? So what is the effective way to delegate then? From my experience, I share the following. One needs to categorize his activities into three buckets. I would term them 1, just delegate 2. Can delegate but monitor 3, can't delegate. Activities under the just delegate bucket are low-risk activities. Even if it is not done well, the risk is low. Such activities should be delegated without any hesitation. Filing bugs in the system, documentation of an issue, filling checklists, attending not-so-critical meetings, code/design fixes which are not complex, etc., could be few examples. Again, these activities will differ from one leader to the other. As long as a failure on the delegated task is manageable, then one should not hesitate to delegate. Activities under the can delegate, but monitor, are those activities that are reasonably critical that if they fail, then the effort to recover is more than the effort needed to do it by yourself. These are the activities that I see most leaders hesitant to delegate. But on the other hand, these are the activities that are ideal to groom your next level leaders. Challenge the next level leaders with such activities. As the risk to fail is not low, you need to monitor these activities. Also, you should not expect them to do those activities exactly as you would do. As long as the end result is correct, you should be willing to accept the different paths that lead to this result. You can review these activities at some regular interval so that they can be corrected if they go off track. Code reviews, reasonably complex feasibility analysis, debug of an issue, etc., could fall in this category. Activities under the can't delegate are those activities that are strategic and need more maturity. These are activities that your current role demands, and they could also be the activities at the next level, your bosses. Many of these activities are important but not urgent activities. Being good at these activities is critical for your career growth. Networking, cross-organizational activities that create visibility, helping your boss on the strategic initiatives, are few examples. As a leader, one needs to create more bandwidth for the last category by doing effective delegation of activities in the first two buckets. Loneliness of leadership. Chapter 20. Stress at work is mainly due to the fear or anxiety of not meeting the expectations of the job or that of the boss. You are convinced that the expectations being set are unreasonable, but you have little choice but to agree to it. Sometimes you may be stressed because of the office politics, especially if you don't know how to handle it. If you think any of these stress creators will go away over a period of time, then you are mistaken. Changing groups in the current company or moving to a different company is not a solution. Wherever you go, you will have some or the other stress. Interestingly, how much you are stressed is dependent on how you respond to the situation. Situation being the same, some people are better than others in managing stress. So, you too need to manage the stress and not expect the external environment to change. From my experience, following techniques helped me manage stress at work. 1. Acceptance. Accept that stress is part of life and stop denying it. Let's say you have signed up for an aggressive commitment. But you are not convinced about it. Every day, if you brood over the fact that you are not convinced, you will remain in the self-denial mode, and it will add to your stress. Accept the commitment and work towards it with a positive attitude. 2. Remember that you are not indispensable. God forbidden, if something happens to you, the project or the company will not collapse. If Apple can survive and grow even after Steve Jobs' departure, definitely your company can survive without you. Reminding yourself that you are not indispensable would alleviate the stress to some extent. 3. This too shall pass. I strongly believe in this adage. The situation that looks stressful today, when you reflect on this in the future, wouldn't feel that stressful. Before you go for a critical management review, you are anxious and stressed out. Irrespective of the outcome of the meeting, after the meeting the stress level will be a lot lesser. Either you did well and felt happy, or you know you messed it up. Either way, your mind is clear. You can reflect upon such past incidents in your career and build your own experience of "this too shall pass." This will reduce the stress. 4. Attached attachment. Emotional attachment to work creates stress when the outcome of the work is not good. You need to develop detachment to the outcome of the work. As quoted in Gita, your right is in action only, never to the fruits. You need to have attachment to the work that you do, but you need to be detached with the outcome of the same. Many a times the outcome of what you do is not totally controlled by you. In my experience, I have worked on many high-pressure projects that was very stressful. But then few of these projects were shelved for business/political reasons. I felt so dejected with these experiences that I started to emotionally detach myself with the outcome of the work. As they say, do your best and leave the rest to God, is a good mantra to follow. 5. Put work in its rightful place in life. These days you hear premature deaths of young professionals. For a moment you feel bad for the person and his family, but then you move on managing pressure at your workplace, not wanting to think that the same could happen to you. But what if it could happen to you? Sometimes, thinking on these lines makes all the things that you do at work look so minuscule. If so, why should you let the stress at work get onto your nerves? 6. Healthy lifestyle. Having a reasonable daily exercise routine helps manage stress. Doing yoga and meditation definitely helps me. Sometimes when I am stressed out, I go for a long brisk walk. The adrenaline that gets pumped due to this brisk walk relieves the tension. Having good night's sleep is a must. Here again, you need to detach yourself from work before you hit the bed. Thinking about the work before sleeping is of no use. You know that you will get to it the next day, so why bother and spoil the sleep? 7. Hobbies. Having something to do other than work is a great stress buster. People who have hobbies are at advantage. If your life is centered only around work, then you need to seriously look at developing few interests besides work. This becomes more critical when you are close to retirement. You cannot fade into retirement, you need to work into your retirement. Active presentation skills. Chapter 21. As a middle manager, you will be making presentations to the senior management on project deep dives or critical project issues. You need to make a positive and lasting impression in the short FaceTime that you get with the senior management. Effective presentation skills are required to make a good impression. There is a difference between making a presentation to the senior management and to others. Senior management being busy, very little time is available to present to them, so the presentation should be short and crisp. As they are also key decision makers, one bad presentation from you can change the fate of your group and its growth. So you must be very diligent in your preparation of your presentation.